Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Ahí va a llegar el gol del Arsenal. Özil marca Mesut Özil.
Se mete a Aubameyang aquí.
This is Arsecast Extra.
Hello and welcome to another Arsecast Extra. This week, James is on holiday, so in the hot seat, delighted to welcome back Tayo Papula. Hi, Tayo.
Hello, mate. How are you?
I'm okay. Yeah. How are you doing this Monday morning after a North London derby?
Yeah, good, good. Thanks for having me on. I've just realised, I might tweet a picture later. I've just realised I'm actually dressed like an Arsenal tragic by accident. I've got my Arsenal pyjama bottoms on and I've got my sort of bruised banana tracksuits up. And I just hit just accidentally. So it's perfect for the day after a North London derby.
It is a shame we're not doing a video podcast because I think people would be, they'd be well into that. The Arsenal pajamas, the bruised banana, what a combination. It's beautiful.
If enough people ask, then I'll tweet out a terrible photo later. But anyway, so we got more interesting things to talk about than my sartorial choices on a Monday morning.
Yes, we do. There was the small matter of the North London derby yesterday. 2-2 draw between Arsenal and Spurs. And it is just one of those games traditionally where I know the old cliche about form going out the window might annoy a few people, but the games are always close, generally speaking. They're difficult. And in the circumstances, a point, given the fact we were 2-0 down, feels all right-ish. But we have to balance that with the fact that we made some real mistakes in that first half and gifted them two goals. And they are basically the last people in the world that you want to give presents to.
No, absolutely. I mean, as you say, the way to draw a game is to come, you know, if we're going to draw a game, let's do it that way around, right?
Yeah.
But then you are kind of tinged with regret. Not only because of the foolishness of the goals that we gave away, but the fact that we couldn't then go on, you know, and get a winner. But as you say, you know, you just want to come out. You don't want to lose that game because it's too hideous, and especially on our own place like that. And yeah, we got out of jail, but we got questions to ask. But at least we can do them this morning from a place of not so much anger, which is what it was looking like at one point. And I was thinking, oh Christ, I've got to speak to Andrew in the morning, and I am. Absolutely fuming. But here we are.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, I suppose the first thing is don't lose. So we did that, you know, successfully enough. Obviously, the target is to win, but do not lose to them. And it looked for a while like we might lose. But let's chat just very quickly about the lineup and the formation that Unai Emery put out there. Everybody wanted to see him play that front three of Aubameyang, Lacazette, and Pepe. I think there are some questions to ask about how that is deployed and, you know, the various strengths and weaknesses of that. But there was also a midfield three behind that. We'll talk about the front three in a moment. Were you happy enough with the team when you saw it?
I mean, no, I wasn't, but it was the team that I expected, if that makes sense. I mean, we wanted to see that front three, but we're talking about someone who has come across as a fairly cautious manager. So if we were going to get the front three that we wanted, there was going to be that kind of caution and concession behind. And I think that's what we saw with that midfield. You knew he was going to play, and I'm sure we're going to talk about him. You knew he was going to play Xhaka because he plays Xhaka, right?
Yeah.
You thought he was, you knew he was going to play Guendouzi because he always plays Guendouzi as well. And of course this time that turned out to be the right thing to do. Torreira is in his first 11. Now, So that's what you kind of expected. It was more it seemed to be there to kind of temper the devil may care attitude of playing that front three.
Yeah.
And I think that is what you kind of expect from Unai Emery. So I wasn't surprised by that, but I do think it's harsh on Ceballos, who obviously had a great home debut. Yes, he struggled at Liverpool, but who didn't? I thought it was harsh on Ceballos. And again, we'll talk about that, how we needed that kind of creativity. It was also arguably harsh on Willock, who's kind of started well. And you do get that feeling that there isn't always that kind of a meritocracy at Arsenal at the moment, you know? So it was what I expected. And I had my doubts about it. And in some ways that was proven, but you know, I think that he was afraid, and to be honest, we were a little bit afraid of their rampaging midfield, them on the break. Maybe Pepe's going to need more cover, and so on. So I wasn't surprised that that happened, but I was surprised at how ineffective those choices ended up being when it was supposed to solidify the team. It's seemed to do the opposite.
Yeah, so I mean, look, if I were to say to you this morning, you know, when you think about that midfield three and you talk about Ceballos and the impact that he had, if I was to say to you this morning, who would you have dropped out of that midfield? I think the obvious answer, given what happened, is going to be Xhaka, right? Because that's the player that people are finding frustrating. We'll talk about him in a bit more detail in a moment. But in terms of that midfield three, cold light of day in hindsight is a wonderful thing, but do you think maybe Ceballos in place of either Guendouzi or Torreira might have been an option for Emery in terms of the way he was thinking? Because as you say, he plays Xhaka because he always plays Xhaka, and I've got a little bit of a theory about that, which I'll expand on in a moment.
Yeah, I mean, do you know what? Yesterday, before Xhaka had gone to Xhaka, I actually thought, and problem's the wrong word, but I thought Torreira struggled, right? He didn't look at the pace of the game. It's not for me to say whether he's fit or not. He's a lot fitter than me. And, you know, you see how they go during the week more than I do, of course. But he looked like he struggled with the pace of the game. And he also, in a more advanced position, he was being bypassed very quickly. And Spurs did play quite well at the back. You know, obviously they're playing on the counter-attack. They've always got Son there, which is always a worry for us. So I thought that Ceballos for Torreira, as you say, in hindsight, would have been a better move. And I was surprised that Torreira didn't come off at half time. I just thought he struggled in that kind of more advanced position. We've always decided that he's going to be there to sit. Amy Lawrence did a great piece in The Athletic a couple of days ago saying about how Torreira was chosen over Nzonzi.
Yeah, well,
this
is my theory. This is my theory about the Xhaka thing as well. It ties into that. Like, I'm not necessarily convinced that Emery is convinced by Torreira. And the fact that they
had... I agree. Yeah, yeah. No, that's a fantastic line of thought.
Yeah, so they had to, like, sit down with Unai Emery and say, no, we want Lucas Torreira rather than Steven Nzonzi, for various reasons. Obviously, one of them was the fact that Torreira was 22 and Nzonzi is 29, so you get nothing back on the player in the long term if you sell him at some point. But I think Emery likes big players, or likes physically big and imposing players, and that's why perhaps he seems willing to overlook some of the deficiencies in Xhaka's game, some of the mistakes that occur on such a regular basis, because he wants a big guy. He just wants a fucking big guy in his midfield, because he wanted Nzonzi, had to be convinced, no, we're going to go with Torreira. And it feels to me just a little bit like he isn't 100% sure of using Torreira in his midfield, which is why Xhaka seems to get a bit of a pass. And even afterwards, you know, Emery was saying about Xhaka, I'm very proud of his performance. The penalty was one disappointing action, but overall, you know, I'm proud of the way that he played. And that's a talking point we'll come to now in a minute. But, you know, it just strikes me that there is a bit of an issue there with Torreira and Emery from a trust point of view, it might not be personal, but it's about his own preference in midfield as to the type of player that he wants. So a small, active, bustling, busy guy doesn't quite do it for him in the same way as a tall, lanky guy who can, you know, win headers and stuff.
Yeah, I think you might be onto something, Andrew, because... Oops, sorry about that. Let me just make sure I turn that off.
That's all right. We have some, you know, some WhatsApp noises every now and again. The podcast is fine.
I think you're right, because so then you have a situation where you've got Torreira on the field because he's in his first 11, but then he's playing in a position which he's not entirely suited to, or it seems like somebody like Ceballos, who we've been crying out for, would be better in that position. You know, Torreira's a great player, and I'm not going to start denigrating him. Of course I'm not, but or he's potential to be a great player, I should say. But and he has got creative touches, and of course he scored a great goal in a forward position against them lot last year, and he was in the box quite a lot. But I don't think it worked as well yesterday. Maybe that's something to do with his fitness, as I said. So I just don't think that three worked the way that we hoped it would at home with that front three that we had, and the link between the midfield and that front three was a struggle, certainly in the first half. When Unai Emery did that press, said that thing about Xhaka.
Yeah,
I laughed and my toes curled, thinking about your head exploding at that time.
Yeah, well, it sort of did, but I'd had the benefit of a couple of glasses of wine last night, so it didn't induce the kind of rage that it might normally do. Well, you know, let's sort of talk about Xhaka. I want to come to the front three in a bit, but let's talk about Xhaka's mistake. And we'll talk about the first goal in a moment too, but the recklessness with which he slid in the box to give away a penalty in the North London derby was, I would like to say, astonishing, but not in the least bit surprising to me, because we've seen Xhaka, he really is just a clumsy guy. You know, he's a clumsy player. I don't think there's any real lack of effort from him. I think he tries hard. I think his heart is in the right place. He wants to do well. You know, even when he makes a mistake, to give him his dues, he doesn't let the head go down. He doesn't go missing. He doesn't hide. He tries to get back in the game. And, you know, yesterday I watched him in the first few minutes of the second half, when I had half expected him to get yanked off because of the terribleness of that penalty concession. You know, he's head up. He wants the ball. He uses the ball. He tries to play. So, you know, all of those things are to his credit. But the way he gave away the penalty was just absolutely ridiculous. You know, at schoolboy level, you would be castigated for making that kind of a challenge in your own box. And I don't understand why a seasoned pro is sort of not allowed to get away with it, but somehow it doesn't put his position in the team under any threat, because this is not the first time it's happened, either under Arsene Wenger or Unai Emery. So let me throw the question at you this way. If we can all see that this is a problem with Xhaka, that this is a consistent issue with him, it's not that it happens every week, but it happens too often during the season, at what point do we say, okay, we can't blame the player for this anymore, because he has shown us who he is over and over and over again? Do we not have to start talking about the person who picks him in the team, despite knowing this?
Well, you touched on this earlier when you said that, you know, Emery said, yes, he made a mistake for the penalty, but I'm proud of the player. So, and he's the second manager to benefit from this very kind of generous attitude. They must think, and we'll come on to what we think in a sec, but they must think that his qualities outdo his... I was going to say occasional stupidity, but
increasingly frequent stupidity.
Increasingly frequent stupidity, but there is also a point where then somebody does just get chopped, and I think we're closer to that. Yesterday, he had to say what he had to say out loud. What are his benefits? his long-range passing. He is, to use the words of the sagely Andrew Mangan earlier on, he is a big fucker, which is which is a way of putting it. He's a big fucker, and
he is sort of experienced in a midfield with relatively young players like Nduzi, Torreira, Ceballos, Willock, none of them over 23 years of age. So he is sort of the most experienced player in that group, but doesn't play like the most experienced player.
No, not at all. And I think it's certainly time. The penalty was... I just watched it again just before we started recording. I mean, it's the levels of stupidity. It's Son. It's in the box. There's loads of players around. It's not like he was getting off a shot. It's not even a it's not a last ditch tackle.
Mm.
He's clean. He's absolutely cleaned him out. And I was watching. I say, you know, we sit on halfway line.
Yeah.
Behind the away dugout, kind of by where the press box is in the west stand. So trying to look past Pochettino's increasingly large back. His thighs are enormous, but we'll come on to that another time, or maybe not at all.
I was watching
Shaka. I'm obsessed with things like that. You know that.
Yes.
Shaka had the decency to hang his head. Shaka was berating himself. But you've done this before. Well, mate, you've given away six penalties. Is it five or six penalties, which is the most anyone has done since he since he started in the Premier League.
Mm.
It's just stupidity. But there was a challenge, just staying with this, there was a challenge later on, very late in the second half, near the end, right in front of us, where we really lost our shit. It was like Harry Kane was out on his feet, the plodding idiot that he is. Later on in the game, he was absolutely shattered, right? He's trotting towards the touchline. He's knackered. He can hardly move. And he's looked over his shoulder. And Shaq, I don't know if you remember it, Shaka's comes bounding up. It was just one of those, you get loads of those, right? But it was just the stupidest foul, the most momentum-breaking foul. And you can see it coming a mile off. And you can see that Shaka just... He's not thinking about it. He doesn't know what else to do. It's the most primal instinct that he's got, and he just knocks him over. And then he just looks afterwards like, what? Oh. But he almost knows he's done it the minute he's done it. Do you know what I mean? He's going to keep on doing this, is what I guess I'm saying. And in the most stupid situation, you know the parable about the frog and the scorpion? Right?
Yes.
Scorpion, hear me out, right? Cut a long story short, it ends up going, you can look it up afterwards, the frog asks the scorpion, why did you sting me? And they're both going to die in the middle of the lake. And he says, because I'm a scorpion. Shaka is going to foul because Shaka is going to foul, right? This is the only thing he needs to do, the only thing he knows how to do. He's not going to change at any point soon. So therefore, that time might have now come.
Yeah.
You say, managers keep on picking him. But that time has come, I think. And when you see progress on the same pitch in the shape of Guendouzi, then hopefully that will hasten his departure or more. But I think we're stuck with him for the rest. I think we're stuck with him this season, the first half of this season, and you hope he'll get phased out after January. But I think he's going to be still Emery's, favourite boy for a bit longer.
Oh, my God. Well, yeah, Shaka is basically a football scorpion. And the sting in the tail is that it costs us points, and it cost us points yesterday, because if you give Harry Kane a penalty, that fucker is going to score it, because he's a really brilliant penalty taker. And I'm quite tired, I have to say, of us giving Tottenham penalties. Really, really fucking stupid penalties. It's very, very, very annoying. You talked about Guendouzi. We'll come to him, because he is definitely one of the positives. I think with Shaka, if Emery continues to pick him, and if Shaka continues to make these kind of mistakes, then I do think, as much as the player frustrates us, we have to look above that and think about, why he's in the team to make those mistakes in the first place. We'll see what happens after. Let's touch on the first goal before we start talking about some of the positives from an Arsenal point of view. not a particularly good look for the centre of our defence. Socrates came to win a header, which he got nowhere near. Luiz got bypassed very high up the pitch, and that allowed Lamela through. Leno with a save, which I don't think he really covered himself in glory with either. And then to compound his initial mistake, Socrates was basically unaware, completely and utterly unaware, that outside him, Eriksen was charging up the outside. I mean, all he had to do was, while he was running back, just glance to his left for half a second to notice that Eriksen was there. It was not great from Socrates. And again, when you're in a fixture like this, and it's only 10 minutes in, you make a fairly basic mistake like that from a long ball. That was the other frustrating thing for me. Lloris just booted the ball from his own box, and too often that's been our undoing.
Yeah, 100%. Doubly frustrating because it had been after a really bright start from us. And you're right about that straight ball. That was a really frustrating thing. But, you know, they were doing their... they were trying to bring us onto them, which we allowed them to do. And as you say, Socrates didn't have to come for that ball. Shaka's there. He just needs to stand off it. And if Kane wins the header, then... then he's there to mop it up. You mentioned about how easy it was for Lamela to, again, proceed straight down the middle each time. He hits it a little bit early. And, you know, David Priest, he said that he was giving Leno a bit of a pass because his position, he says that his position made it very difficult for him to palm it out of Eriksen's path. Fair play. I'm there watching it going in with my untrained fan eye going, just put it somewhere a little bit, just don't pad it out to him, pal. So that seemed like a bit of a mistake. And and again, watching it this morning, you're watching Socrates kind of berating himself after the event. It was a really, really soft goal, and we've done that far and that happens far too often for a, you know, a top six Premier League defense. But yeah, it was just mistakes all around. As I say, it was really, really frustrating because we'd started brightly and it just sucked the energy out of us. And I was really, I mean, I've got a bit of a thing for Eriksen. I really want him to leave so I can enjoy him in the same way that, you know, Modric became much more fun for everyone when he buggered off to Real Madrid. And I was disappointed to see him start. But you know, you're not expecting him to. Socrates is supposed to be one of the quickest at the club, so you don't expect. Well, he's more stupidity than outpaced, but really don't expect to see Eriksen winning a foot race at the back post and being the only person there. Where was everyone else?
Well, Maitland-Niles had gone across to cover because Maitland-Niles had to go and try and cover the Lamela shot. So he was doing his job. But I don't even think it was a question of pace. It was more about awareness and for a player of his experience not to even take one glance to see was there anybody outside him is very odd. So, look, you know, they will punish you. They do have good players, Tottenham. And, I mean, it did suck a bit of the life out of it, but it felt to me, you could correct me if I'm wrong here, that there was a, you know, a pretty good atmosphere inside the stadium. Obviously, when you play them, there's a sort of togetherness, you know, in that, you know, everybody hates Tottenham. So whatever happens, whatever frustrates people on the pitch, the desire to get one over on them permeates through the crowd.
Yeah, the stadium was fantastic yesterday. And again, I want to come onto it, but before there was, you know, the goal before halftime was fucking fantastic.
Yes.
For the atmosphere, for the game, for everything, and it really was. And I'm sure we'll come to that. But Spurs tried to come down, especially in the first half. You know, they were trying to come at us down the left so often, and they must have Emery must have known that and told them that. So therefore, just reiterating what you said, just to be that brainless and to not be aware of that. As their tactic, they were overloading on that side. You know, Son was coming on that side. Son and Eriksen were overloading on the left all game, and they were trying to get that quick pass out to them. So for Socrates to forget his role, his position, his responsibilities like that was really frustrating.
You talk about the goal just before halftime, and that was huge because going in 2-0 at halftime, I was feeling very flat. very, very flat, I have to say, going into halftime. And I was quite worried that, you know, if that were the case, and Tottenham came out and nicked another one early in the second half, it would become a very, very difficult day for everyone. But the quality of Alexandre Lacazette yesterday was apparent, not just in the goal that he scored, but the way that he played. He really, really tried to make things happen. He tried to recover the ball. He tried to, you know, win it back from deep positions. He was defensively aware. I think it speaks a little bit to the fact that we didn't have that player in the first half who was able to connect properly between the front three and midfield. So Lacazette dropped deep, but you know, you can't look at this guy and see the shift that he puts in, the work rate he has, and then the quality that he has to score that goal. I mean, the ball from Pepe, there was a great bit actually when Pepe gave him the ball, and his first touch was amazing. His second touch was perfect. His third touch to smash it in with his left foot was sensational. The whole goal, his precision and his quality in the box is brilliant. But if you watch the replays, before he's even put the ball in the net, Pepe's got his two arms in the air because he knows when Lacazette puts himself in that kind of position, he is going to score. And it really is the kind of goal that sums up his own particular characteristics in the opposition penalty area, where he doesn't have a great deal of time, he doesn't have a great deal of space, but he does something which gives him enough to find the finish. And it was the same with the goal against Burnley, wasn't it? Where he's being basically pulled down. He takes a couple of touches on the turn. As he's being hauled to the ground by one of those Burnley wrestlers, he fires a shot in through the legs of the goalkeeper. And I think actually both the goals that we scored yesterday were, what's the word I'm looking for? Not stereotypical, but very representative of the two strikers that we have.
Yeah, I mean, Lacazette's strength, we see time and time again. Of course, you know, in footballing terms, he's a Diddy man, right? but he's, given the size of, you know, you mentioned the Stoke, I mean, Burnley defenders the other week, and what he did time and time again, holding the ball up, you know, traditional number nine state vibes with someone who doesn't look like a number nine, you know, a traditional number nine, or at least a Premier League number nine, right? And that goal yesterday, which gets better and better when you watch it, you know, it was a real, in derby terms, it was a real, what I was calling it yesterday, was a real fuck-off goal. It was a real...
Sanya a few years ago.
It was Bakary Sanya. It was RVP in happier times. It was Van Persie and it was Sanya. That one, you know, the beginning of the comeback. And just, I know you've always had a thing about goals coming off the crossbar, right? But there's just an emphatic thump from that close in is delicious enough. The fact that the two touches before it were fantastic. At that point, it sounds silly, but we weren't going to lose at that point, right? We weren't going to lose. We might not necessarily we're going to win, but just shut up and sit down. Where I sit, just watch them jumping around, the jumping bean thing, watching them over there. It's so frustrating. I know UA fans are always there, but it's something about them doing it. Mm. And then to score, you know, Sanya scored down that end, Van Persie's curler in the comeback against them. Goals down that end, just delicious. And he, just before that, actually, the other striker, because Aubameyang, I think, dispossesses Sissoko, which sort of starts the phase of play, which then ends up with a free kick, which ends up, you know, with the VAR shout that we never had to deal with Rose's. I think it was a handball. I haven't seen it again. So both strikers played a fantastic part in that. Pepe's ball in. I'm not even sure if it was. I mean, I wonder if it was meant for Lacazette because it came at quite a pace. Almost like, I think Torreira was behind him. It felt more like it was going to be a natural one for Torreira, but he just cushions it, sets himself up and buries it. And at that point, it just had to happen. Halftime was a completely different beast. Of course it was. That's an obvious thing to say. But again, in the stadium, there wasn't enough time to sink into the depression of being two down.
Yeah.
To them at home and start wondering, how you're going to go to work the next day, you know?
Yeah. Look, at timing, huge. And obviously, it gives you a huge lift before you go in to halftime to have scored. It puts, you know, the shits up them a little bit. You know, they would have, they could have played sensible and taken a two-goal lead in, and maybe it would have been a different game. I thought it was quite funny.
He's a real leader, Andrew.
Like I said, yeah. Absolutely.
You know, in again, not the most kind of obvious way, not the way that, say, Emery wants Granit Xhaka to be, but he just kind of, he gets on with it. He finds the deficiencies in the team and tries to do, like you said, like the way he was trying to, okay, there's a link, the link up between ourselves and the midfield isn't working, so let me go and get it, even though I'm supposed to be playing in the kind of more central role. You know, you see him kind of cajoling, and he's a very good defensive forward as well, which doesn't always kind of get highlighted. Winning challenges quite high up, you know? So, it was a shame to see him... Shame to see him come off. What was that? I mean, the commentary.
Yeah.
What was it? What was the problem?
I think it was a hamstring, but turned out apparently to be a bit of cramp or something like that. But he did very definitely signal to the bench that he needed to come off because, you know, ordinarily you don't take off Lacazette to put on someone like Mkhitaryan, especially given what's going on with Mkhitaryan at the moment. And we'll come to that in part two of the show. Yeah, well, there's another talking point. Just before halftime, you won't have heard this, though, but Jamie Redknapp was bemoaning the Arsenal performance just before we scored that goal. And he thought that we needed to make a change. I'm just going to play a little clip here from Sky Sports. This is who he said we should bring on. You need to listen carefully to this because it took me a while to figure out who he was talking about.
I'll be amazed if he doesn't make a substitution at half-time. He's a manager that likes doing that anyway. He has to bring on Celibacy, he has to bring on Ozil or somebody just to do something different.
What?
Yeah, hang on. Let me just play it again.
He has to bring on Celibacy.
We had to bring on Celibacy. That's who we needed. My goodness. I mean...
Celibacy. The Guinean forward that we didn't know that we'd signed.
Yeah.
Bless him.
Know. Yeah, I don't know. He sounds like some kind of reggae musician. I don't know. But there you go.
Wow. Okay, fair play, Jamie Redknapp. What was it? What was it like on the... How annoying was the TV yesterday? You never know this. I always wonder.
It wasn't as annoying as last week because I think it was, you know, if you step back from it objectively, it was a really interesting and kind of exciting game for the neutral, which the commentators are basically. So they seem to enjoy it and seem to enjoy some of the aspects of the performance. You know, Neville was talking about how our midfield three wasn't quite right and defensive mistakes. He was quite nonplussed by Xhaka, actually. Neville, he was talking about Xhaka saying, I've never seen anyone make as many fouls. I've never seen Xhaka play without making 50 fouls in the first half. And somehow he always seems to get away with it, which of course, you know, I think he was talking about in terms of bookings. It took Xhaka until the foul that you mentioned in about the 90th minute before he actually got a booking. So there was an element of bewilderment about Xhaka's performance and his mistakes. Redknapp, I don't know. Whenever he comes on, I just go, ooh, as much as possible, because I just, you know, I prefer not to listen. But when he says something like,
he has to bring on Celibacy,
you're like, what did he just say? Anyway, we scored a goal not long after. Go on.
A word for, I know we're here for Arsenal positives, but just a word for their shithousery, right? To stem the tide, okay, you can call it professional, or whatever. It's kind of what you expect from, you know, an Argentine coach, but
yeah,
a lot of rubbish, niggly breakup fouls that, for so, you know, for a team that fates itself as this kind of a creative powerhouse. If you listen to any of their fans, then there was a lot of really nasty, niggly fouls. It took a long time for Lamella to get booked.
I would book him just because of his face. Like the minute, if I was a referee, the minute Lamella stepped on the pitch, I would give him a yellow card just because of his face. And the minute he did anything else, he'd be off.
He looks, acts and struts like a pound shop Cristiano Ronaldo, doesn't he? And yeah, for that reason alone, he needs to be booked, because at least Cristiano Ronaldo is good. You, Lamella, are not. Harry Winks, albeit being the best player yesterday, but he got away with one in the second half after he got a,
yeah, the after he got a card.
And there was just a lot of niggly pulling and nasty fouls that that you've seen given. I mean, they got, I don't know how many yellow cards. They stopped putting up the cards on the screen. But how many did they get yesterday?
I don't know. Two or three?
Maybe. It felt like it was more, but it was just a very nasty, niggly, for whenever, you know, trying to break up momentum, which I know is,
but that's what
I
they
know
do.
Is standard, but I was just very aware of it from yesterday.
They had five. So Eriksen, Winks, Lamella, Sanchez and Danny Rose, which sounds, yeah, Rose, Sanchez, Winks, sounds like the worst law firm in history. but yeah, look, I agree, but it's part and parcel of what they do. And, you know, I think we have to learn to live with that and learn to cope with it, because they do get away with it. And I think maybe Tim Stillman has made the point that because they play like that all the time, it just becomes par for the course. Whereas when Arsenal do it, it's not really who we are. So the fouls become a bit more obvious. But like the Winks one, when he was grappling with Socrates, if Socrates got booked there, I have no idea why Winks didn't get a second yellow. But look, let's move on and let's talk about our second goal. And we can talk about it from the point of view of we should mention, I suppose, the fact that they hit the post. like really, really hit the post. Like they hit the shit out of that post, so much so that when they hit it, like there was this moment, I don't know if it was the same in the stadium, but like it looked to me like everybody just stopped for a second. Like just everybody, players, fans, everybody just went, what? And then there's a moment where the ball just rebounds and Luis goes, oh, fuck, and just puts it out for a corner on the rebound. But holy shit, that was a moment which would have probably changed the game in a very significant way.
And it really, I mean, you're spot on in the stadium. It was like, I don't think there was a massive amount of, you know, we're still focused on the second goal. There's still, the momentum's with us. And in the blink of an eye, you know, I think there's three passes, like kind of bypass our midfield, or bypass our defence, sorry. And there he is on the side. And he hit it. And, you know, the chat is one way. I just, where we were, suddenly it was like, ooh. Oh, fucking hell.
Yeah.
Oh, fucking hell.
Oh, shit.
Well, that was good. And I mean, it was an amazing shot. Mm. And it was more, much easier to enjoy and say that because it came thumping out the right way. But it really was a case of, I mean, as a really loud, satisfying, you know, Van Nistelrooy at Old Trafford thwack of the post, right? Which you can enjoy when it doesn't go in.
Yeah.
But yeah, But those kind of focused the mind a little bit, right? After that, it was like, oh, hang on. It's not a procession to our second goal and then the third. It really kind of sort of sat us down a little bit.
Yeah.
And then you're like, let's get past the corner and then we'll equalise. So, yeah, fair play, but it didn't happen to them. And then and that equaliser wasn't absolute beauty.
It was. Well, I mean, he brought Ceballos on a couple of minutes after Kane hit the post, so I think that might have prompted that change. The other thing I just want to talk about in terms of the goal, I want to talk Guendouzi, and his pass obviously was superb. There's a bit of a problem, isn't there, for Emery when he considers that front three? Because Aubameyang, when you see him out on the left fizzing in crosses, you're going, this is not what Aubameyang should be doing. This is not what he should be doing, because he's such a deadly penalty box striker. His movement, his instincts in the box are superb. As we saw for the goal, like Guendouzi gets a huge amount of credit for the precision of his pass. But it's only because Aubameyang is right there making that run between the defenders that they can't live with. It's his movement in the box, which is so sensational. But if he wants to play that front three, he kind of has to compromise in that Aubameyang has to play in one of the wide positions, because the options that we have in the wide areas are not necessarily that convincing. Like, you know, Mkhitaryan came on yesterday and absolutely stank the place out. And thankfully, he's now moving to Roma. It seems just a matter of time, maybe before we end this podcast, his move to Roma on loan for the season will be confirmed. So you can kind of understand it a little bit from Emery's point of view. He's like, well, Aubameyang, I lose something by playing him on the left, but also my other option is Mkhitaryan, really, or he goes really young with Nelson or Smith Rowe or Saka or something like that, and I don't think he considers them quite ready for a game of this magnitude. So I have a touch of sympathy there, but the goal, he's in the middle, he's playing as a central striker, and Guendouzi picked him out perfectly.
Yeah, I mean, on the goal, first of all, I mean, yes, the pass is fantastic, but those are really hard as a, it's a straight ball as a striker, so for him to find the angle from that pass, if you see what I mean, from it was sensational, the way he kind of opens his foot out and guides it into the corner. It's such a brilliant striker's goal. A lot of was said about Guendouzi's pass because of the game he was having, but for that kind of, you know, that goal doesn't come, of course, so we say that he's in the middle, but his run, the way that he kind of fashioned the chance, opened up the chance from, as I say, quite difficult. It's quite difficult with those kind of straight balls at that pace to do what he did. But you, so at the point in the game when he's come inside and Lacazette's come off, that's what, you know, that's kind of what we signed. That's what we signed him for, right?
Yeah,
for him to kind of lurk in that. Lurk in a circle around the penalty box, around the 18-yard line. He can do a very good job coming in from the left. And as the season develops, Nesta Bios hopefully takes more of a prominent role in the team. If one of the youngsters you mentioned, Nelson or Saka, comes into the team later on, then maybe he won't be forced out there. But equally, what's the option with if our two best players are those two, we were also complaining last season when Emery was working this out and was leaving one of them out. So I can't see any other solution.
Yeah, it is a tricky one because
it's a problem.
Yeah, I think it's a problem, sort of exacerbated by the fact that the two of them yesterday saved our bacon. I think it was, you know, the points we got from the point we got from this game was, I would say, more down to the individual quality of our forwards than the cohesion of the Arsenal performance, if that makes sense, which isn't to ignore the fact that we really put a lot of pressure on them in the second half. And when Ceballos came on, it really, really freed up Guendouzi, who had probably his best game in an Arsenal shirt. And I hope it's one of those coming of age performances. But, you know, we can talk about him in a moment, but the goals we scored, I really think, are down to their moments of individual quality rather than the product of the way Emery wants his team to play, which is still something I'm not really sure of.
I was going to say exactly the same thing. And I think that's always going to, I think that happens. I think we're getting away with stuff game to game because of these individual moments of brilliance, because those two dragged us to almost fourth last year because of, you know, an inspirational performance from game to game, rather than, like you say, rather than any kind of, because I still don't know how Arsenal set up. I still don't know what we are, who we are as a team. And that in itself is a worry. You know, if the front three, if Pepe, you know, works on his final ball and we can become as lethal as, you know, the front three of the two best teams in the country at the moment, which is obviously the aim, then you can say that that's the Arsenal personality. But I'm still really struggling with it. And I think we are going to improvise in a kind of jazzy way each week with our two best players pulling something out like that, whether it's them combining. We need to see more of those. We need to see more creativity in the midfield. Hopefully, like you say, Guendouzi's going to kick on. I think Ceballos is super key to this, whether it's going to be Torreira or Xhaka alongside him. The fact that we haven't even mentioned Ozil, which I'm sure we'll come to in the second half, is insane. still, by the way. But again, more of that in a minute. But I think you're right. I think we're jazzing along game to game at the moment with individual moments taking us somewhere. And it's a long season to get away with doing that, you know, especially given that we're always, it seems, going to ship goals at the other end. So, you know, you go in, it's seat of the pants stuff at the moment. It was a thrilling game yesterday. It was a thrilling, it was thrilling enough to see us kind of cohesive at home against Burnley.
Yeah.
But I still don't know who or what we are, and hope that the manager's going to wear that out.
Yeah,
me, it's his second season to do that.
Exactly. And, you know, it just feels to me sometimes like there's always a reason why we can't talk about this and why we can't have a discussion about what our footballing identity or philosophy is. So, you know, the Newcastle game, it's the first game of the season. Lots of players are out injured, of course. Yeah, that's fine. That makes sense. Burnley game, first home game of the season. We still don't have our fullbacks. You know, players are coming back. Pepe isn't fully fit yet. Torreira's not fully fit yet. You know, blah, blah, blah. Liverpool, well, that's basically a write-off. Liverpool, you know, are so good. What's the point in even trying to analyse the way that we play? North London derby, well, that's a special game. You know, you can't really analyse it outside the context of it being the derby. You know, so When is it okay to start wondering or talking about how it is we're going to play and what way or what kind of football Emery wants these players to play? So, you know, it is his second season. He's had a big summer in the transfer market. The club have absolutely backed him in the transfer market. And I think it's important that over the coming weeks, after this international break and, you know, in this first part of the season, that we start to see some kind of identifiable footballing philosophy from the head coach. I don't think that's unreasonable.
No. And if I was going to set myself up on the other side of the fence for that, could then say that, but Andrew, we're a month into the new season when he has been backed. But Andrew, we don't have our first choice fullbacks who are going to change the way hopefully we're going to play, because I'm a huge fan of Ainsley Maitland-Niles. I'm not a huge fan of Kolasinac. And when you've seen how, you know, the masterclass that we get most weeks from Liverpool's fullbacks at the moment, we're hoping for that when Bellerin and Tierney kind of make their appearance. So then we could say, let's see what happens then. But that still doesn't allow for the fact that the midfield is not functioning with any kind of regularity. And you could argue, again, I'm sure we'll talk about it in the second half, you could argue whether we have the right defensive pairing. And yeah, you've got this issue out there about what we do with our front two players. But maybe it's still a little bit too early, but if you have me on doing this again in November, then I think we can get nuclear about it.
Yeah, yeah, sure. And look, I'm really excited about the idea of Bellerin and Tierney coming in, because I think they will definitely add something. But are we a team that is so dependent on having two fullbacks to transform the way we play?
Well, given that,
you know,
at one point last season, our entire way of trying to score was get it to Kolasinac and him to fire in, often more often than not, hitting the first defender. Mm. Given that that was our main way of trying to score a goal for a while, then yeah, maybe we are, right?
All right. Well, look, okay, before we go into part two, because we've had a good waffle on this game, and look, we could have won it. There were some chances. Kolasinac was offside in the build-up, and, you know, the late part of the game got weirdly crazy open, didn't it, the last 5 minutes. It was end-to-end stuff where they could have scored and potentially should have scored, but thank the Lord for Sissoko. He is just he's the best. He really is the best at missing chances against us when he should score. Like, his consistency, the quality of his misses, he's right up there. 10 out of 10 for that guy.
I'm a huge fan of looking up in the 89th minute and it's Sissoko doing that. That sliding nothing at the end was just exactly what you want after a really long, tiring North London derby. And this, like you said, the space, you know, the game was, you can't even call it stretched, because there was no, it was incredible at the end. Yeah. Like you say, but end-to-end stuff.
Just on Sissoko, there was a great bit at the end of the first half where the ball came to him on the edge of our box, and it was, you know, it was set up for a shot. And Martin Tyler goes, Sissoko, this could go anywhere. And it went fucking into the stand. Oh, it was funny.
Yeah, we've seen it be Eriksen. We've even seen, you know, Poundshot Ronaldo do good things at the point. So we were very lucky that it was Sissoko. But look, once again, I mean, what was the last rubbish North London derby? We're not neutral, but what was the last boring North London derby?
I think the home, maybe it was the last home one in Wenger's. I can't remember. It was maybe a couple of years ago. I think Koscielny scored for us. Or was it an own goal by that guy with the massive big fucking head? You know, he looks like the son of two farmers. Eric Dyer, exactly.
The fact I knew who you were talking about when you said that.
I think he scored an own goal and maybe we gave away a penalty or something, but it was a really odd, inhibited kind of 1-1 draw. I remember it being very atypical for a North London derby. They're usually eventful games. Just before we go into the second half, I do want to talk about Matteo Guendouzi and the performance that he put in. There's clearly a player of real, real potential in there. And when we needed somebody to step up and try and drive the team forward yesterday, he was that guy. And he's only 20 years of age, and he's, you know, he's obviously confident and he's full of self-belief and everything else. But I think he deserves a real mention for the way that he played yesterday. It was very, very impressive.
Yeah, 100%. He was obviously man of the match yesterday. And a word, you know, jury's out for a lot of stuff we've said about Unai Emery. And I think we all said at some point last season, he's playing this guy all the time. So when, you know, he's got energy, he's got a hustle about him, he's got enough kind of, he knew it was a North London derby, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. Like, he's got that in him. He's got that little bit of needle. You watch him driving on the other players. I think there was one tackle in the second half where he just goes steaming in and goes to ground, needs to get the ball, and does, you know. Creatively, apart from just a goal, he seems to be going forward a lot more than he did last season, or at least trying to drive forward a lot more. So he seems to have, like, added, there was one right in front of us, I think it was in the first half, where he goes kind of unchallenged with the ball for 30 yards, which was, there seems to be more intent about him. And he's been arguably front to a side, most consistent player since the start of the season. So really good for him to get that assist. Just great to watch it. I mean, obviously he looks great with his hair flying behind him. Mm. But as a 20-year-old, not taking any shit, driving on the players around him and standing up to... He stands up to midfield players from the other side who have got more experience and are older than him or more heft than him every week. And, let's hope he kicks on.
Yeah, all right, cool. Well, look, he was very, very good and deserves a lot of credit yesterday for his role in our getting something from that game. Right, we had better take a break because we've got questions from the listeners to do, and we'll do that in part two right after this.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog. Welcome back to the Arscast Extra. This is part two of the show where we will answer the questions that you sent to us this morning on Twitter at DJ Tayo and also at Arsblog on the Arsblog Facebook page, facebook.com/thearsblog, and on the Arsblog Discord server, which you get access to if you are an Arsblog member on Patreon. As you're the guest and as you're standing in for James, who is at this moment in time probably sunning himself in Spain, eating a gigantic bucket of ham on ruffles and probably drinking a beer, I think it's only right that you get the honor of the first question this morning.
Thank you very much. So, right, I've got one here from, we've got a few on this theme, but I like the way Dare Dibble at MKM118 puts it. In light of the Mkhitaryan loan news, what the actual shit-splattering, tit-jiggling fuck was Emery thinking in giving him a run out? That the Emirates faithful would give him a fond farewell?
I genuinely... the only thing I can think of, because I think we have to assume that the Roma thing didn't just happen after the derby. We didn't just get a phone call and say we'd like to loan him. You know, maybe it did happen that quickly, but I suspect it was probably in the works. I don't think it was about giving him a fond farewell from the Emirates crowd. I think he just wanted a player who has got energy and who can run. And Mkhitaryan has issues with, you know, passing, controlling, shooting, contributing, and those things. But he's definitely physically fit. And I think he wanted a player who kind of matched the energy of the game. Which he sort of did. Like, I didn't think it was a great substitution. I thought he was absolutely terrible when he came on. I would have preferred to see Reece Nelson get a run out. I could see why he was reluctant to play Ozil in that position, you know, given it would have been his first start of the season, and throwing him into a game like that when we were a goal down, you could make a case that Ozil's creativity could have been useful for us, but, you know, in the end we got the goal. So the only thing I can think of was he didn't consider Reece Nelson ready enough to play in that game, which is odd to me. But yeah, it's a strange decision, and it has been a pretty awful time at the club for Mkhitaryan. I think we had a question here, Dan Young, who's at Danny P. Young, who says, can you think of a worse swap deal in football history than Sanchez and Mkhitaryan?
Well,
I know you can.
I mean, I went straight at it. I think I said, I know that we're recording in a minute, but the words Gallas and Ashley Cole, I think I said, came out and have hit me in the face so hard that I've got stars in my eyes as I was tweeting back. Yeah, so that's the worst swap deal in history for me. And I know for one of the reasons, which I know I won't say clash on, because we don't clash on anything, Andrew, but I care more about shirt numbers than you ever will or can do.
Oh, listen, but, the 10 thing.
Yeah, everything about the everything about Gallas, everything about him having the number 10 shirt, and everything about us losing a very good left back, whatever people think of him, makes that the worst swap deal in history. But this isn't far behind, really, because no one's come out of this well. I just want to give a follow-up question on that Mkhitaryan one from Tom March, which is at Tom M. March, saying, can we afford to offload Mkhitaryan, who's been decidedly average at best, when we've already sold another central midfielder in Iwobi, who's now obviously going to get 20 goals this season for Everton, and now he's found his shooting boots?
All of them with his head. All of them. He scored two headers in a week for Everton. I don't think I ever saw him score a header for Arsenal. Can we afford to? I wonder if we would have sold Iwobi if Mkhitaryan had gone first.
Yeah.
I do wonder about that, but, you know, it's water under the bridge. I guess the decision they're making is, A, they're getting his wages off the wage bill. They're getting rid of a player who has basically underperformed, apart from one six-week spell where I think he played pretty well. Last season when he came back from injury, he came into a team which was quite tired and added some energy and played quite well. I think it's been a very underwhelming loan spell, and I'm being as diplomatic as I can here about Mkhitaryan. The thinking behind it, I guess, Edu and Raul and Emery to an extent are making decisions not just based on the need to get rid of his wages, but also the need perhaps to clear a path for some young players to come through. So if Mkhitaryan goes, it probably means that Reece Nelson gets more minutes. It probably means that Emile Smith Rowe will get more minutes. It probably means that Bukayo Saka will get some more minutes, even if those are just Europa League minutes to start off with. So from that point of view, I think they're saying, look, can these young players be worse than Mkhitaryan? And they've come to the conclusion, no.
But given that we've spoken before, and I'm sure I'd love to see you over the season, maybe speak to someone, you know, an Emery expert on what we can expect from him. Because you say this, but is he the type of person in the Premier League who's going to give these guys a run out? I mean, I guess a lot of it depends on how they do in their, you know, with their Europa League.
Well, I mean,
chances.
In fairness, he did start Willock, you know, for the first three games of the season. He started Joe Willock and he started Nelson in the first two games. So, you know, there is perhaps some evidence that he is moving in that direction, even if last season he seemed a bit reluctant.
Yeah, I hope so. I just, you know, I think he errs on the side of caution, and I hope I'm wrong. We want to see these exciting players. We want to see these exciting young players, and yeah, look, I hope you're right. But just staying on this subject just for the minute, if the rumours of Mustafi and Mkhitaryan leaving are true, what material do we make the statue of Don Raul out of? And that's from Kyle Destructible Cake, at Destructible Cake on Twitter.
I don't know. Solid gold? I don't know. Like, if he can get rid of Mustafi as well today, that's a fucking hell of a transfer window that he's presided over.
That's the only reason I wanted to mention it, because they have done well.
Yeah, they have. And it seems a bit unlikely at this point that Mustafi is going anywhere, because there don't appear to be any links to any clubs whatsoever. I know there was some talk about Juventus. Apparently Juventus looking to take him on loan because Chiellini's done his cruciate ligament. But like, if you're Juventus, what is the first thing that you do if you're considering that? You have a quick word with a Mr. Aaron Ramsey. And I don't think Aaron would lie to his new club. So there's no chance of that happening.
Absolutely. Whose turn is it? Is it yours?
It's my turn. This one comes from... Bum, bum, bum. It's from the Discord. It comes from Tom Jones. That's not unusual. Anyway, he says, morning, chaps. What did you make of Pepe? Lots of promise, but lacked composure at key times. Were you surprised that he didn't dribble at Rose far more than he did after the early yellow card? Was it poor instructions from the bench or a lack of game awareness?
I enjoyed Pepe yesterday. I enjoyed his close control.
Yes.
Which, you know, and he's not afraid to have players around him, which we haven't seen for a while. I mean, Ceballos was the same when he came on. Yes, he was lacking in with a couple of final balls. Really, none more frustrating than the breakaway at 2-2, which could have found Aubameyang with a little bit more with a little bit more care. But he's going to gel with his front three. With his fellow members of that front three. So I thought he had a good game yesterday. I think he's finding himself. Obviously, I mean that's such an obvious thing to say. Of course, he's finding himself. But I think he's acquitting himself a lot better than a lot of players do when they turn up in this league. He's got confidence. So I enjoyed him yesterday. Yeah, frustrating with that final ball. Really frustrating with that final ball. But he's also giving us he's another player on the pitch who's giving us that creative option. We've talked about Aubameyang having to play out wide, to create chances for the rest of the team. We've gotten one step closer to having more players on the pitch who you're comfortable with going forward, who are going to make the right decision. He's getting closer to the right decision. Yeah. So I'm okay with that.
Yeah, look, it's been quite amazing, I think, to see some people really questioning Pepe after, this was his first start in the Premier League, and it was a North London derby. I thought he did quite well. Certainly some of his close control, his ability to hold on to the ball in tight spaces and actually find a bit of room for a pass is very impressive. I think the finishing and the confidence around the penalty box will come in time. People can talk about, he hasn't scored a goal yet or anything like that. But, with all due respect to him, better players than Nicolas Pepe have taken a while to get off the mark at Arsenal. Yeah. Thierry Henry took, 10 games to score a goal, whatever it was. And Dennis, it was 8 or 10 games as well. So, it's way, way, way too early for people to start making sweeping judgments about him as a player, about his ability to fit into the Premier League, about how good he's going to be. We just don't have enough evidence or, performances to make any kind of judgment in that regard. Is completely unfair as well to start making these declarations about how good he's going to be or won't be, because you just don't know yet. You don't know. I think the signs are promising. I think he was better yesterday than he was against Liverpool, and I think it'll be incremental to an extent with him. But I reckon once he gets on the same wavelength as the other two, and once we figure out a way of playing with a midfield that can connect our front three with the rest of the team,
yes,
then I think we'll see him really flourish. So, let's just fucking calm our jets a little bit with regards to Pepe. There's no point going, over the top.
No, I agree. I want to talk about, so does Nico. Nick 4768 wants to talk a little bit about Sokratis.
Right.
Sokratis's erraticness seems to go under the radar with most fans for a variety of reasons. One, not being Mustafi. Yeah. Two, new player. Three, his passion. If Holding comes back into the side, is it at his expense or Luiz's? Do we stick with these two? You first.
It's an interesting question, because Holding usually plays as the left-sided centre half, and Luiz is being played as the left-sided centre half. Luiz made some mistakes in the Liverpool game. Sokratis made a big mistake in the game yesterday. So it's hard to know. It's hard to know. I guess it depends what Emery wants. Wants from his central defenders. Does he want the passing range of Luiz, for example? In which case, then it will be Sokratis who drops out. I mean, I think he's an all right player. He's not brilliant. He's wholehearted. He does like a tackle. We enjoy the shithousery when it's not too damaging towards us. But I don't think he was anything other than really a stopgap signing, two or three season signing for us. He's not somebody around whom you're going to build your defense. Look, I think we have a collection of central defenders who are capable of making mistakes. Thankfully, not all of them with the same frequency as Mustafi or Xhaka in midfield. Yeah. But I there are limitations to to him as a player, and those will be exposed over the course of the season.
Exactly.
I think in general he'll be all right. He's never going to be brilliant, and I'm looking forward to Holding coming back and really putting some pressure on those two. And yeah, look, it seems that Chambers is very much considered the third choice between those two, but there'll come a point that if they keep making mistakes, Emery might have to consider otherwise. So look, he's fine. He's just one of those players who will do his job pretty well for the most part and will have some moments that make you put your head in your hands.
Yeah, I mean, look, Luiz is going nowhere for a start, I don't think. As long as he doesn't drop a wicket every week, I think he'll probably start every week. I do think that. And Socrates, I thought it was quite an interesting question because of the idea that, you know, because of what he's not, i.e. Mustafi, because he is fairly new and because, we, like you say, we enjoy the shithousery. But I think you also bang on there saying that he was never more than a stopgap. And I don't think if the criteria is would anyone else around us, around our level, want him? I don't think he's that. And I do think that I do sometimes worry about, and I'm shitting myself every time another player gets in the box at the moment, which leads me on to the other reason I wanted to talk about it, just to mention that I feared the worst when Harry Kane dived yesterday from where we are, because as I say, from where we are, all you can see is Socrates very close to, you know, one of the Premier League's incredible diving geniuses. And I just thought, there we go again. And you do wonder if Socrates' reputation will follow him around. We saw the mistake he made for the Matip goal. I just think that kind of defending has me very scared very often. So,
yeah, particularly in the VAR era, isn't it? Where he's strong, he's physical, but he's also a wrestler, a bit of a grappler. Kolasinac is similar as well in the sense that his method of defending in the penalty box is to obstruct as much as possible. And you can get away with that when there isn't the ability for the video cameras to fuck you over, where, you know, if you do it cleverly enough, you can hide it from the referee. But it's not just the referee anymore. So I wonder if he will struggle a bit with that kind of seismic change in how the game is refereed.
Yeah, agreed. All round.
All right. It's my question, isn't it? Okay. This one comes from Gunnar for Life, who's at Whiny Gunnar. And he says, in a game that could have used an injection of creativity, one of our most creative outlets sat on the bench. If you are Ozil, surely this has to impact your motivation one way or the other, positively or negatively. Your thoughts?
Well, which way around is it? Is it his lack of impetus that's leaving him out? Or is the fact that he's left out mean that, you know, he's not bothered? It's really weird watching Ozil. Obviously, they warm up quite close to us, right? Yesterday, I wondered if he'd warmed up at all. The guys I sit with said that he'd been sighted. But at no point did any fucks look like they were given. Do you know what I mean? And I know that's his... part of his strength when he's on the pitch anyway, just, you know, he does everything in the kind of with the elan or the kind of looseness that I normally enjoy in a player. He's not a very good substitute. And he really didn't look like he was part of it yesterday. It's very hard to do. I mean, look, Emery doesn't like him, or Emery doesn't fancy him, and that's where we are now. And I was really surprised. I'm really surprised how the discourse, how he didn't feature in yesterday's discourse in the build-up. I hinted it in the first half when we talked about Mkhitaryan coming on. Why are we not even suggesting that Mesut Ozil comes on in the North London derby? Why is that not happening?
Yeah, I mean, there's another question here on the Discord from Andy Gunner 16, who says, have we moved beyond Ozil now? I can't imagine what he'd have been like in a game of that pace and intensity yesterday, and if we can't trust him in the most important games, is there any point?
Exactly my thoughts, and well put question. Is there any point if he's not? Why isn't he featuring in? Why isn't he featuring in the North London Derby at home? At home as well.
Mm.
And then why is he not even a consideration for a change when we're looking to, we talked about, you know, Ceballos goes on before him. Okay, that makes sense because, but that makes sense because he's got creativity, but he's also got pace and a hustle, right? When Ceballos came on, immediately he's rattling out a 20-yarder, right? To test a goalkeeper. And then G-ing the team up while he's on his way to take the corner. I think he took the corner. And Ozil isn't part of that. So, yeah, I think in answer to that question, we have moved on past Ozil. And I think January will see him leave, maybe, because he stopped contributing to the team. He stopped being expected to contribute by the team, by the fans. I think the manager gave up on him a long time ago.
Yeah.
But the fans are getting less angry or bemused each week. And it's just kind of like, you just sort of shrug your shoulders now.
Yeah, it was very telling, I think, in the build-up to the game where people were talking about what are your formations? What formation would you pick for the derby? You know, and Ozil was not really a consideration for many people. Like the midfield three, for the most part, didn't include him. You know, it is quite telling. I know he's had some issues at the start of this season that have kept him out. Obviously, that off-field stuff is truly terrible. Another illness makes people wonder about, you know, his physical robustness and his ability to deal with the rough and tumble and the pace and intensity of the Premier League. But yesterday, when we needed a goal in the game, I think I'm right in saying that Mkhitaryan came on before we scored the goal. Am I right? I think so. Yes. 67 minutes, Lacazette came off and Mkhitaryan came on. We needed a goal and we put on Mkhitaryan, and we spoke about it a little bit earlier about potentially why that might have been. But I think that's telling, isn't it? That you're putting on a guy like Mkhitaryan rather than your in name, your biggest star, biggest reputational star, and your biggest earner, who was sat down on the bench for the whole game. Like he wasn't even brought on to try and win it.
Yeah, and that's, it still saddens me. I'm not like throwing my hands up and saying, fuck off, Ozil. Like it saddens me that arguably our best player on paper, or our biggest player on paper, I should say, isn't part of this Emery team. And given that we're not, I think given that we're not sure what Emery is or his philosophy is yet, or what his formation is yet, I think that's why I'm still uncertain about whether Ozil can contribute to this or not, because we're not, is Ozil ineffective because Emery doesn't know what to do with him? Because he's still, because surely he's a great player still, isn't he? I don't know. Like, I just don't know.
Mm.
And I can just sit here as a fan and be slightly bemused, and you know, as the tweeter said, sorry, I've forgotten his name. Maybe we've just moved past having that conversation because we're trying to fit other players into the team now. It's a disappointing one.
Yeah.
I've got one here.
Okay.
I've got one here from Damien McBride, DP McBride.
Okay.
Thinking about Xhaka yesterday, who are your top five most mindless Arsenal players of the last 20 years?
Last. Oh my God. Okay. I think.
See how many of them are mine.
Okay, if you've got some written out. Okay, I think one has got to be Eboué.
That's top of my list.
Top of your list. Who else was mindless? I think maybe at times you could make that accusation of Flamini.
Oh, decent shout.
Yeah, because, you know, yeah, there were just moments, weren't there, in games where it didn't work. Let me think.
Flamini gets a pass because of his part, obviously, in the 2006 campaign. But you're right. There was, before the reinvention of Matthew Flamini, as he was pretty mindless when he came into the team. I mean, I wrote down Eboué faster than anything at all. I have a particular, I've said it before, I have a particular long-standing eternal hatred for Nelson Vivas.
Yes, well, that goes way back. I think that's a good one, because that moment, well, it was the 99 season, wasn't it, at Leeds?
It.
Sorry to make you cry.
Yes, it was. Oh, my God. It was 99 against Leeds. Hasselbank at the back post. Yeah, that was the one.
Yeah.
And I didn't like him before. I always hated his chant. Jesus. I always hated him before. And then that moment cemented it in my mind. So he goes in there.
I think another one, maybe it's a very obvious one, is Mustafi.
Yep. Yeah, that's quite current, so I haven't got him in there, but I definitely went for, perhaps harshly, I went for Jovinho.
Mm, yeah, that would be a reasonable one. Who else? I'm just trying to think who else was just like a bit thick, you know? I mean, Bentner, not quite.
Santos.
Say again?
Santos, it's hard to look past Santos.
That's true. That is true. I'm trying to think of some others. I mean, look, there have been a few down the years. Batista, perhaps, could you say?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Julio Batista. Yeah. Stepanovs. Stepanovs, I don't know if he was, you know, mindless, just as opposed to not very good. I think that could be the difference. That could be the difference there. You know,
yeah, I can't. I can only ever think of Stepanov's. I can just see the ball sailing over his head, in the 6-1. Remember when they were at Old Trafford?
Yeah,
I just always think of that ball going over his head. He had a real particularly gormless look on his face, and anything good he did after that, if indeed there was any, I'll never get past again.
Mm.
But yeah, those are there's some good ones in there. I'll be interested to know some more.
Yeah.
I always love.
We didn't even mention Silvestre, so that's good.
Oh my God.
I know. I have a question here though, from our Discord. It comes from Neil Siglechner, who says, do you think the presence of more demonstrably spiky players in the team, and he cites Ceballos, Guendouzi, Socrates and Torreira, can help improve the atmosphere at the Emirates?
Does the presence of more spiky players improve the atmosphere?
Yeah, can it have a positive impact on the atmosphere?
Yeah, I mean, you're getting close to, it can do, you're getting dangerously close to passion, you know, with that conversation, I think.
Don't people respond to that? People do respond. Like, yeah, you know, you can whip up the crowd and everything else. It doesn't mean you're any good, but certainly fans will respond to players who don't back down and who stick up for themselves and stick up for their teammates and get stuck in and all that kind of stuff. I know it does skirt that line, but it is a sort of a visceral thing when you see a guy go in and he creams somebody out with a great tackle and then stands up and does the arms in the air thing. You know, it's just instinctive to react to that, and that would have a positive effect on the atmosphere.
Yeah, no, it does. It does. I mean, we always used to say on our podcast, you need seven, right? And you need seven to have it. I think that came from Tony Adams, actually, who said that you need seven people on your team who are going to have it. And that does transmit, you know. And you do see, like with Socrates and Harry Winks yesterday, you know, Guendouzi, our man of the moment, was one of the first bounding over there to get involved. That kind of spikiness is good. Not taking any shit from an opposition player you don't like. It does whip up the crowd, but you know, I'm as I say, I'm a little bit kind of wary of that because I'd like Lacazette's. I'm more for a Lacazette kind of passion or spikiness, which is sticking it in there but then getting on with it. That kind of transmits itself in a leadership way, and that kind of inspires me in the crowd more personally.
Yeah, okay, that's a reasonable outlook, I think. That's fine.
Right, yeah. Let's see what.
Well, I've got if you're struggling, I've got one here. We'll do one. We'll do one more each. I'll let you get one there. But I saw a lot of people talking about Jose Mourinho on Sky Sports after the game and his analysis of it, and apparently was being quite kind to us. Now, I didn't watch it because, you know, listening to Jose Mourinho is kind of up there with drinking a big cup of bleach for me, so I wouldn't like voluntarily inflict it on myself. But a lot of people asking, for example, Satya Unadkat. Well, that's very difficult. Sorry, mate. But he says, hi, guys. Assume you've seen Mourinho's analysis on our performance in the North London Derby last night. It feels as though he's bashing us less, perhaps angling towards a job with Arsenal after Unai Emery leaves. How would you feel about that? And then Marijan10 on the Discord says, morning, gents. Seeing a lot of people praising Mourinho's punditry and analysis. How scared are you that he could be Arsenal's next head coach? I know it's a bit soon, but I don't think this regime is going to be very patient with Emery. What's your thoughts on that then?
My first thought is lol. No, someone said this in the pub yesterday as well. And look, let's hope it doesn't happen. I mean, he's actually a really good pundit. Of course he is, because he knows loads about football. It doesn't stop him being, you know, the massive wanker that he is. And I actually heard, in that kind of way that you try and inhale as much Arsenal Spurs stuff afterwards. I actually listened, especially when we don't lose, I listened to the comments afterwards. And of course he makes a lot of sense. Do I want to see him at the club? No, because yes, he knows loads about football, but I think his way of disruption and destruction to get results, it didn't work with his last two stints in the Premier League. And I don't think we need or deserve that at the club when we are going in a different direction. That does ask the question. That doesn't discount the current regime from any kind of criticism. And I think it's a really, for obvious reasons, it's a really important season. I think Emery's on a rolling contract now. So I think at the end of this season, it's up for grabs with what happens for him. But if there is a change, then it won't be, I think it'll be a retrograde step to go in the direction of Jose Mourinho, no matter how kind he's being to us now. Of course, you know, I mean, he's the pantomime villain when he's going to be presenting a softer image now. But I did enjoy actually him being in the studio with Big Soul yesterday, I like to think was some kind of television version of shithousery from a producer.
I didn't really watch a great deal of it, to be honest. I try not to, because I, you know, again, when I watch a game and I like as much as possible, you get it through commentary, unfortunately, but I like my opinion of the game not to be shaped by other people's analysis before I start talking about it and writing about it myself. So, you know, if you say he made good points, he made good points. As for the potential for him being Arsenal manager, I think all you can do is roll out the Ben Kingsley from Sexy Beast clip. You know, now. Just no. For me, absolutely no. No way, no how, no way, no, absolutely not. No.
Now, what do you really think, Andrew?
Yeah.
No, okay, so I've got one for you, Andrew. From Jason Green at JM Green 87. What should we do with Ainsley Maitland-Niles once Bellerin returns? He goes on to say, surely our midfield is overcrowded with competition. Brackets is a good thing. And he won't want to play second fiddle at right back. He goes on to say, would you sell him if a decent bid came in?
Well, I mean, no, because we don't have another right back to provide backup for Bellerin. And I don't know that, you know, the contention that he won't be content to be backup to Bellerin is really on the money. I think he probably knows that when it comes to the right back position, Bellerin is going to be the number one. And, you know, he's been asked for the best part of a year now to deputize for Hector, and I think he's done as well as he can. I just don't think he's a natural defender. But what he has done over the last, you know, year, 18 months, is really get a lot of first-team experience under his belt. What happens to him afterwards, I really don't know. I mean, I think for the rest of this season, he will be the backup to Hector Bellerin. I think he'll play right back in some of our Europa League games and what have you. At the end of the season, then, they have to make a decision about what kind of a player he is and where he's going to play and what he's going to be and whether he's going to be that at Arsenal. He's spoken about his desire to be a winger. Like, even if he was to say, right, I'm a winger now, he's going to be behind Pepe. So is he just going to be a squad player for us? Potentially. And he might be happy being a squad player for us for a couple of seasons. And then when it comes to making the next step, it might end up in a similar situation to that of Alex Iwobi, where he goes to a club to play regularly. But because of the playing time that he's had at Arsenal, because he's a young, relatively young English player, he'll be valuable in the transfer market. So, you know, I can look into a crystal ball. I don't think his long-term future is as a right back. I think potentially there's a midfield player in there. But right now, I think he's going to have to just take a step to one side when Hector is back and fully fit, which is going to be a few months anyway. You can't play Hector week in, week out. So he's still going to play a fair amount of football. And over the course of the season, they can make a plan as to what he's going to be in the future. It's a difficult one, though. I do see that.
It's a difficult one, and I think he's probably made his future at Arsenal very difficult by being so versatile. It's interesting that you mentioned Iwobi, and it's a slight hangover of the philosophy of the former regime, really, for these kind of super talented utility players who don't hold... Utility is a tough word there. I should say multi-talented, really, because they can play... You know, Arsene Wenger was very much a fan of having players... Like we've joked about how they all start on the left wing, right? So, and he's going to be kind of damned ultimately, I think, by the fact that he was being so versatile, and the fact that he would have played a season or two at right back when we thought he was going to be first of all a central midfielder. It's interesting you say him talking about a winger. I don't think he's going to be a winger at the club. So that's why I was interested in it as a question, because I love him as a player. I love the little street vibe he's got. I'm a big fan of a look away pass. He's got that in him. He seems to be playing like he's got a way of playing without that. He's playing in a five-a-side pitch somewhere in East London, which I really enjoy. But I think you're 100% right that by the time he unfortunately does move on, because he won't nail a place in our first 11, he'll be a very valuable English asset. And we should, you know, and I think he'll follow the same kind of trajectory as you mentioned, Alex Iwobi. But equally, he's got a great job to do before then. And if he's happy being Hector Bellerin's number two when he's back and raring to go, then I think he'll still enjoy a good time at Arsenal. But I don't think his long-term future is with the club in the way that, say, some of the other youngsters from the academy might hope to do.
Yeah, I think you're right. The lack of clarity over what exactly he is as a player makes it very difficult to predict what's going to happen to him. If we were to get a bit more clarity, if, you know, let's say next summer we go out and we buy a right back, a young right back to understudy Bellerin, and then we say, right, this is where Maitland-Niles is going to be. He's going to play in our midfield. Let's say Guendouzi is the guy doing the Xhaka job next season. There's no reason why maybe Maitland-Niles couldn't be one of the candidates for a midfield role further forward. But, it all depends on what he wants and what the club want from him. So we'll wait and see. You have got one more thing to talk about just before we go.
Yeah, I just wanted to just point out that it would have been Jose Antonio Reyes' birthday yesterday. And a tragically early end to his life, and I just spent a bit of time looking at some of his goals when I got in last night on YouTube. And there's one very nice one that I'd remembered against Tottenham. Cuts in on the left, hugged by Pires. And I was just, yeah, I was just thinking about him and just wanted to just bring to the attention that one of ours celebrated his birthday yesterday. So just that thought.
All right. Well, look, it was a really sad sad news earlier this summer when that happened. And we have in Danny Ceballos, a player who has talked about following in the footsteps of Jose Antonio Reyes. So hopefully he can do that for this season. Just before we go, just to let you know, I am on holidays from tomorrow. So I'm not quite sure what's going to happen with a podcast on Friday. I'm back next Tuesday and James and I will record the next Arsecast Extra on Tuesday because, you know, as much as I love all of you, and I do love all of you, and thank you very much indeed for listening and subscribing and commenting and all that kind of stuff, I don't want to spend the last day of my holiday, you know, three or 4 hours of the last day of my holiday recording a podcast. So I will do it on the Tuesday when I get back. Tayo, thank you for filling in so fantastically for James. It's been great having you.
Thanks, mate. Thanks for having me. And as you know, anytime you fancy it.
Sure, no problem. I will, of course. Until then, folks, take it easy. We'll catch you on the next one.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.